Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, January 19th, 2023. Presidio City Council seeks legal advice on potential game room ordinance by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio. At Monday night's meeting, Presidio City Council returned to the topic of game rooms, which drew heated discussion during public comment at a meeting in November. Two game rooms have been quietly operating in Presidio, but after widespread shutdowns and negative media attention in Odessa, the city of Presidio has started considering regulating these businesses in case the industry continues to grow locally. Gambling is illegal in Texas, but game rooms operate within legal loopholes to simulate some of the fun of slot machine-style gaming within the letter of the law. Proponents of game rooms insist that it's good, clean fun, and detractors say it's a thinly veiled way of skirting the law in plain sight, with the risk of attracting other types of criminal activity. Assistant City Attorney Nella Joseph joined the meeting via Zoom to offer her insight. The agenda as written scheduled a first reading of an ordinance regulating game rooms, but Joseph advised that the council didn't have to follow through and could instead talk through aspects of the proposed ordinance before initiating the formal process of passing a new law. It's a hot subject and a controversial type of ordinance, Joseph said. The conversation then shifted into clarifying what game rooms are and what other cities have done to regulate them. Joseph explained that many game rooms operate on the, quote, fuzzy animal loophole, end quote, since cash prizes of more than $5 cannot be given out in Texas. Game rooms can instead offer non-cash prizes that can be redeemed elsewhere for cash or other forms of payout above the limit. Jaron Stevens, Secretary of the Zoning Board, asked if the city could limit where game rooms can operate. In other cities, they cannot be located within a certain distance of a school or church and can't be on residential property. City Administrator Pablo Rodriguez said that the proposed ordinance would prohibit game rooms from opening on residential property. Councilmember Joe Andy Mendoza was concerned that council's focus on the details could lead to the number of game rooms spiraling out of control. It's good that we take our time with this, but what if many more pop up? He asked. Mayor John Ferguson agreed. I don't see this as a pressing issue, but we want to limit a free-for-all in our community. Joseph explained that there's already a framework in state law that cities can adapt to be more specific. For example, the city of Alpine limits the number of game rooms to 4 and can keep track of how many game rooms there are by requiring yearly licensing and permits. Stevens asked if the new ordinance would apply retroactively to existing game rooms or if they would be exempt from the new restrictions. Joseph advised building a grace period into the ordinance so that existing businesses could get into compliance. You can say that we're going to give you time, she explained. To cap off the discussion, Joseph advised that the state-level laws regulating game rooms are constantly in flux. With the beginning of a new legislative session, they could change even more. This is an ever-changing issue, she said. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. Jeff, Davis County wildlife biologist Olivia Gray with Texas Parks and Wildlife, uses a flashlight to locate hibernating bats underneath a bridge. Bats are being tested for a fatal disease, white nose syndrome, across the state this winter. Texas Parks and Wildlife biologists, volunteers, work to monitor fatal bat disease. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Far West Texas. Local Texas Parks and Wildlife, TPWD, biologists are working with the help of volunteers to test overwintering bats nesting under bridges and in caves and mines for a fatal fungal disease known as white nose syndrome. The disease progresses from the presence of a fungus called Pseudogymnoascus destructans, which can grow on bats when they are in torpor, an inactive state in which their body temperatures are lowered. Bats are irritated by the disease and come out of torpor to scratch themselves, burning precious calories, and die of starvation as a result. TPWD biologists are currently swabbing bats for the disease around the state. In the Tri-County area and in Terrell and Hudspeth counties, those efforts are led by Krista DeMere, TPWD wildlife diversity biologist covering the Trans-Pecos region. DeMere was a part of the team that first detected the spores of the fungus in 2017 in the Texas Panhandle. White nose syndrome originated in Europe and was discovered in the United States for the first time in the winter of 2006-2007. An online map shows how the disease has since progressed from occurring primarily on the East Coast to spreading across the country. Since that point in time, bats all across the country, but mainly starting in New York, were falling out of their roosts during the winter. They'd find them on the landscape. The ground would just be littered with dead bats, said DeMere. By 2020, the presence of the spores led to the development of the disease in Texas, said DeMere, primarily affecting bats in central Texas, where the majority of the state's cave systems are located. In 2020, we started documenting bats come out of hibernation and just fall across the landscape, said DeMere. People were calling into Parks and Wildlife. I found a dead bat on a hiking trail. What should I do? I found a dead bat in a parking lot. It was really in 2020 that we documented the actual diseases here, white nose syndrome itself. Millions of bats have died in the U.S. due to white nose syndrome, according to the White Nose Syndrome Response Team, a group organized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. DeMere explains that the mortality rate of colonies affected by white nose syndrome can be as high as 90% to 100%, and there is concern that certain species, including cave biotis, which hibernate in large numbers in central Texas over the winter, will be wiped out. We're extremely worried about that specific species, and we're doing everything we can to not only monitor that species, but any other wintering bats we have in Texas, said DeMere. DeMere began swabbing hibernating bats in West Texas for the first time in the winter of 2020-2021. Samples are sent off to Northern Arizona University for testing. Her first year, all of the samples she sent in came back negative for the fungus, except for one Mexican free-tailed bat she swabbed in Big Bend Ranch State Park in Presidio County. That was the first documentation of the fungus anywhere out here in West Texas, said DeMere. Mexican free-tails, even if they carry the spores, haven't actually developed the disease, so they could be more of a carrier, But it's the other bats that they could come into contact with that we're worried about. This winter, Demir is out swabbing bats again, beginning with all of the bridges she visited 2 years ago, but expanding her reach to local caves and abandoned mines in Shafter, Big Bend National Park, Guadalupe National Park, and more. Demir, with the help of Texas Master Naturalist volunteers and fellow Jeff Davis County wildlife biologist Olivia Gray, has been working to survey areas for dead bats, count roosting bats, fluoresce bats with an ultraviolet light to see if they can pick up any indication of the fungus, and swab the bats for samples. Any help that I can get from volunteers is great. This is all work that I can do by myself, but it goes by a lot faster and smoother having extra hands, said Demir. Bats are often found roosting in cracks under bridges. Using what she calls the bat tickler, a dowel rod with a swab-sized hole drilled into the end of it, biologists and volunteers are able to get into the cracks, too narrow for human hands, in order to reach the bats. Bats often make noises in protest or open their mouths to bite the swab. Researchers are often targeting their noses for the samples. Gray joked that she felt like she was brushing bat teeth. So far this year, Demir said she has encountered significantly fewer bats than she did in the winter of 2020-2021. She said she has definitely seen less of the cave myotis species, particularly. The first bridge she visited in Brewster County, the site of a known myotis maternity colony that has housed a sizable population of bats in the past, was almost entirely empty this year. I only found one bat in the entire bridge this year. That's a little scary for me, said Demir. Other bridges recently surveyed showed declines from 1,500 to 133 bats and 500 to 121 bats over the course of 2 years. The severe winter storm that took place 2 years ago, after Demir visited the bridges, and the more recent December cold snap could be to blame for the struggling populations, said Demir. Most bat species have 1 to 3 young a year, meaning their populations are slow to recover. Texas is known to be home to over 30 bat species. The majority of the bats Demir and volunteers have come across are Mexican free-tailed bats, with the exception of a singular bat of the Yuma myotis species, known to exist near water. It is possible that the bats that remain in Texas for the winter are juveniles who are unaware they are supposed to fly south for the winter. But even today, said Demir, little is known about the migratory patterns of bats. Transmitter technology, which allows scientists to track animals' movements, has previously been limited. The bats are tiny. Most of them are less than 10 grams. So having a transmitter that you can put on something that small, the technology is just now getting here, said Demir. In addition to bats being a huge tourist attraction in the state of Texas, sites including the Congress Bridge in Austin, the largest urban bat colony in the world, as well as Bracken Cave in San Antonio, the largest congregation of any mammal on the planet, attract thousands of visitors. Bats eat their body weight in insects every night and contribute to a balanced ecosystem. Bats are estimated to provide $3.7 billion worth of assistance to farmers for their pest management services, according to the White Nose Syndrome Response Team. People do not realize how important bats are to the agriculture industry. Farmers already spend a ton on pesticides, and that is with the help of bats. The amount of money that would have to be spent to battle those pests without that would be astronomical because bats take care of a huge portion of insects that target our crops, said Demir. The region is also home to a breeding population of the Mexican long-nosed bat, an endangered nectar-feeding bat which travels north from Mexico in the spring to spend summers in Emery Cave in the Chisos Mountains of Big Bend National Park. The Mexican long-nosed bat is the main pollinator of agave plants, which are used to produce tequila. Other studies, including an agave and yucca study at the Chinati Mountains State Natural Area, have also taken place. We would not have tequila without that bat, said Demir, because the disease has not been found this far west and south before. We have no idea what it's going to do to a nectar-feeding bat like the Mexican longnose. They plan to continue monitoring efforts and may make management decisions based on this year's results, said Demir. Fort Layton State Historic Site in Presidio is another popular roosting site in the area for bats. Its crosshatch wood ceilings are home to hundreds of Mexican free-tailed bats in the summer. The site also put in a giant bat house near the structure that is also utilized by bats, though nowhere near the level of the fort, said Thomas Forwood, the site's superintendent. Guano cleanup is a daily morning routine for us once it warms up a bit, said Forwood, referring to the accumulation of bat excrement. While there is a lack of day-to-day personal accounts from the early days of Fort Layton in general, and none mentioning the presence of bats, Forwood said the flying mammals have likely been there since the site's inception. The layout of the site has remained the same throughout history. It's been a perfect roost site. We figure since the early days of Fort Layton, bats have definitely utilized this structure, said Forwood. The fort's Mexican free-tailed population leaves the site to fly south during the winter months, meaning they do not have a large hibernating colony or hibernacula. This makes the population fairly low risk, so the fort does not actively swab for white-nose syndrome. The fort also sees Yuma myotis and cave myotis species. Canyon bats, a species of concern for the disease, are also found at nearby Big Bend Ranch State Park. Park employees keep an eye out for sick or dead bats and alert natural resource specialists as needed, said Forwood. While the populations of bats at Fort Layton aren't of immediate concern for white-nose syndrome, Forwood said there is still a lot to be learned about the disease and its spread in the West. There's a lot of question marks, so that's some of the reason that there's a lot of research and a lot of concern, said Forwood. It's a concern for ones that have similar physiology to ones in the East that have been affected hard, but also for what's going to happen here. Union Pacific hosts a law enforcement safety course to prevent track fatalities. By Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. Union Pacific on Tuesday hosted a course in Marfa for local law enforcement focused on public safety around the railroad tracks that run through the city and surrounding region. Union Pacific hosts the course in communities along its tracks every few years. The company has done so three times in Marfa within the past decade, according to Union Pacific spokesperson Robin Tesver. Marfa Police Chief Steve Marquez estimated the last course held in Marfa took place in 2018. The course, though held in Marfa, is a regional affair. Tuesday's course was attended by officers with the Marfa Police Department, the Presidio County Sheriff's Office, the Presidio Police Department, the Texas Department of Public Safety, and by firefighters with the Marfa Volunteer Fire Department. Marquez noted that Presidio's involvement was especially vital given the anticipated completion of the city's rail bridge. Mike Brooks, Union Pacific's public safety special agent in El Paso, said the company's goal is both to educate law enforcement officers and first responders and to increase public awareness about track safety. It's for public awareness so we can get the word out that the railroad tracks are dangerous, said Brooks. The course's return is not in response to any one incident, he said, but a series of incidents. It's in response to a collection of incidents, said Brooks. Every year, trains strike about 2,000 people. That's vehicles and pedestrians. And of those 2,000, probably 1,500 of them are seriously injured or killed. He was careful to note that was roughly 2,000 collisions total, not collisions involving Union Pacific trains. The railroad tracks in Marfa have, in fact, been the site of several tragedies. In 2013, Marfa resident Melanie Parker Rayburn was struck and killed by a train near Russell Street. Her death was ruled a suicide, though the family claimed her death was not properly investigated. In 2016, Marfa teenager Jason Molinar was struck from behind and killed by a Union Pacific train in Marfa while walking on the tracks with headphones on. The child's mother sued the railroad company, alleging operators failed to properly notify her son or slow the train in a timely manner. A 2019 trial concluded with a jury verdict in Union Pacific's favor. Last year, the 8th Court of Appeals in El Paso upheld the trial court's ruling. And more recently, in 2021, a less severe incident took place at a crossing, resulting in two injuries. City of Marfa Public Utilities Supervisor Chuck Salgado was driving his truck over the railroad crossing near the cemetery when struck by a Union Pacific freight train. Salgado and his 9-year-old son, who was in the truck with him, were injured in the incident. Salgado was charged with failure to yield right-of-way at railroad crossing. Chief Marquez said for his department, the local tragedies are top of mind. We all know about the tragedies we've had along the railroad tracks, he said. Brooks said the public should be aware that land within 25 feet of the rails is railroad property, and that anyone on that land is trespassing. That land is not labeled as such, he said. Union Pacific owns 35,000 miles of straight-line track. There's no way that we can mark all of that. But police may enforce trespassing laws to keep the space around the tracks clear. Marquez said his department's protocol is to inform anyone too close to the rails that they are trespassing and to issue citations if necessary. Tuesday's course will not result in any new or increased enforcement, he said. It simply serves as a reminder of existing protocols and informs new officers who have joined the department since the railroad's last training. Brooks said that Marfa specifically has a tendency to draw visitors who might want to trespass for a photo opportunity. Marfa, because of its art draw, you have a lot of people, and the railroad tracks draw those people wanting to take pictures, those people wanting to be on those tracks and take pictures, he said. Marquez said his department had dealt with people sitting on the tracks or getting too close for the sake of a photo. His officers tell those tourists to keep a safe distance. We try to tell them to stay off the tracks. If you want to take a picture of the train on the other side, from the post office, or from where the St. George parking lot is, that's fine. But we want everyone to stay away from the train. we explained to them that we've had incidents in town. Following an overview of the laws and protocols as part of the course, Union Pacific took officers on a train through Marfa. Observing motorist and pedestrian behavior at all four crossings in Marfa, said Tisfer. Officers were also stationed along the tracks during the exercise to ensure safety rules were observed and enforced. Tisfer issued a few safety reminders for Presidio County residents. Drivers should expect train traffic from either direction on the railroad, and trains can be closer, faster, and quieter than you think. Trains can take more than a mile to stop once operators have applied emergency brakes. Drivers should never drive around lowered gates, and if their cars end up stalled on the tracks, they should get out and notify the number on the blue sign near the crossing. Lastly, Union Pacific urges drivers and pedestrians alike to only cross at designated crossings.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, January 19, 2023. FSISD to receive significant security upgrade by Nathan Hewer. Following the Uvalde shooting on May 24th, the Fort Stockton ISD made security upgrades an urgent priority with the placement of ballistic film at all student campuses, an increase to 5 school resource officers, and the approval of the Guardian Plan. The FSISD school board further the district's effort to increase security at all student-attended campuses on January 17th at a special meeting. The board approved the purchase of door sensors for all exterior entrances and exits at 6 campuses and card reader systems. The deal, which cost the district more than $620,000, includes a 10-year licensing agreement with Verkaba that enables the district to replace equipment if needed during the span at no additional cost. There's going to be certain doors you can come in, but all the other doors will have sensors to let the administrators know that the door is open, said Gilray Madrid, Fort Stockton Assistant Prince Superintendent. Even if a door doesn't have access control, it'll let them know it's not secure. Originally, the district was targeting the beginning of next school year for installation of the equipment. That timeline was minimized due to Verkata's inventory and timeliness with the entire installation process. One of the determining factors in choosing Verkata over the other vendor in consideration in Lubbock-based Guardian Security Solutions. The installation of the equipment will begin before the end of February, according to Roy Alvarado, Assistant Superintendent. One of the things that was always important to us in the timeline, Alvarado said at Tuesday's meeting, they'll process the inventory right away and it is in stock. They can get it to us within a week, and the installation process, once everything has arrived within the 4 weeks, has been able to start with boots on the ground doing the installation. The upcoming Fort Stockton ISD bond projects took an initial step forward on January 9th at the district's special board meeting. The school board approved an architect firm for the bond projects, which will be paid for via funds that were approved by voters in the November 8th election. Fort Worth-based VLK Architects was selected for the bond projects within the district. We focus almost 100% on education. Our firm is based on building long-term clients and relationships. We have a wide range of experience, and we want to get you the best projects for the money that you have. VLK Architects provide their services to school districts across the state, including the recent Pecos ISD bond projects. The approval of the architect firm allows the ISD to advertise for a construction manager for the bond projects. This is the resolution that was drafted in conjunction with our attorneys, which is allowing us to advertise now that we have architects for the construction manager at large. If everything goes well here at our board meeting at the end of the month, we can come forward with the different construction managers that want to take on our projects. Ultimately, the decision is going to come down to the board to decide who it is that they want to go with based on the advertisement. Zamora explained that once a construction manager is chosen, the school board will still have complete control over the bond projects. The entire process is put in a position where we are not locking in, he said. When they say we are going to build a field house and this is how much it's going to cost, we hope to come in under that. We again have the opportunity to say it doesn't sound right to us, but if it does, it's guaranteed it will be no more than this amount. Then we go project by project. We have a timeline that's already laid out. Some of them are already underway. The security is at the front. For Stockton ISD and Texas Tech Partnership adds mental health needs. Today's children and adolescents deal with an array of psychological and emotional stresses that keep them from learning, developing, and achieving at their full potential. The issues are not all dealing with COVID or the effects of social isolation or the learning loss that our children are experiencing. COVID did not start the rise in our youth needing additional psychological and emotional support, but it did make the problems worse. COVID and school safety concerns have also put a spotlight on the need to get these kids more support. Depression, anxiety, ADHD, PTSD, self-harming behavior, stress, school safety concerns, increased crime, all are adding pressures failing to make academic progress, and psychiatric problems are all being experienced by many of today's children and adolescents. All of that doesn't include the pressures of just being a teenager, such as anxiety, dealing with parents, teachers, friends, boyfriends, and grades. Most of us adults struggled with as well during our school years. The Fort Stockton ISD and Texas Tech University at El Paso have agreed to form a partnership to help support the psychological needs of the children in Fort Stockton ISD. The board gave its approval for a joint agreement at its December 12th meeting. A member of each campus counseling staff has been trained in the program, and now students, parents, and the Panther community are being informed of the program. The program focuses on early intervention. Services are free and participation is voluntary. Families are allowed 2 cancellations and or no-shows to the appointments. Any more will result in discharge from the program. Referrals to other existing community programs will be provided upon program completion, only if needed. A senior mental health clinician will assist with the referral process. Neither FSISD nor Texas Tech program can cover the cost of medication if prescribed by a psychiatrist. If a student is referred to outpatient therapy upon completion of the program, neither will cover the cost of the outpatient therapy. The parent or guardian must be present at the first session to gather family history. The therapeutic relationship between a therapist and the client contains an abundance of confidential information. This means that it cannot be shared without the consent of the client or his and her legal guardian. Commissioner's Court hears open cattle range concerns by Sean Yorks. Open range land grazing for cattle in West Texas dating to the 19th century and is still practiced today in some parts of Pecos County, but a high volume of vehicular traffic has created dangerous conditions for drivers. Jennifer Gonzalez addressed the commissioner's court on January 9th in the hopes that rangeland could be fenced in order to keep the cattle off the road. She presented photos of recent vehicle v. cattle accidents involving Fort Stockton and Imperial residents. The roads of Pecos County, specifically 1053 and 1450, have become dangerous due to a few landowners who abuse the Texas open range law, adding that in December 2022, a landowner who does not reside in Pecos County placed their cattle on open range land. 3 cows were hit in the matter of a week. According to Texas law, Texas is an open range state, meaning that a livestock owner does not have a legal duty to prevent animals from getting onto the roadway. However, since 1876, the Texas legislature has allowed Texas counties to vote on whether to become closed range. State law mandates that all state and U.S. highways are closed range. Farm-to-market roads are not included in that mandate. Pecos County is a relatively vast county. The negligence of a few landowners have become a huge problem for the citizens of Pecos County, namely in the northern part of the county. Gonzalez also claimed that 1053 is a state-maintained highway, providing photos of TxDOT employees fixing fencing and removing a dead cow involved in a January 6th accident. Currently, anyone who runs into and hits livestock on farm market roads is responsible for not only themselves, they are responsible for the damage the animal has caused because negligence cannot be proven due to the open range law. From my understanding, some land and livestock owners who are taking advantage of this law or choosing to graze their cattle in our county are not local citizens. She said the problem has become such that a group of residents researched what can be done to fix the issue. The landowners have a duty to prevent their animals from entering the highway pursuant to the stock law. Stock law will change Pecos County in part or in whole from an open range county to a closed range. She noted that the majority of ranchers in Pecos County are responsible and do their best to keep their animals fenced. I don't want to go about this to punish our ranchers. Gonzalez asked the court to consider adding a measure to the ballot to make areas of Pecos County closed range. I don't want someone to die as a result due to negligence of a land or livestock owner who did not secure their animals. County Attorney Frank Lacey said that in order to put such an item on the next ballot, a petition would be required. It's not really action for the court to take. I'd like to come back with a petition. Lacey told Gonzalez to contact county judge's office once she has the signed petition. Schuster added that the number of required signatures depends on whether it's a countywide referendum or specific precincts. Sheriff Perkins said it's been a problem for more than a decade. We're out there every other day putting cattle up. The problem areas are near the sinkhole and power substation between Fort Stockton and Imperial, and fences go down for various reasons, including vehicles driving through the fences. The sheriff added that it's a pointless effort because as soon as the cattle are put up, they go right back out. TxDOT plans to install warning signs as well.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, January 12th. Commissioners discuss solutions for 36th Street flood zone. Architect for new jail selected. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. Ward County Judge Greg Holly opened a discussion about flooding and drainage problems on West 36th Street from Colorado Street back east to Loop 464 during Monday's Ward County Commissioners meeting. Quote, I have been working on this for some time, trying to come up with a solution for the flooding on 36th Street when we have a lot of rain. During July of 2021, we had a really significant amount of rain, some might say one of the 100-year flood-type rains, Judge Holly said. Red Ornelas, whose home is on 36th Street and flooded during the heavy rains, and has been working with Holly to find a solution. Quote, I have spent time talking to business owners and residents out in that area, and I have studied the lay of the land, so to speak, and have begun to discover that the Thrasher development, located on the west side of the loop, is slightly higher ground than the 9 to 10 blocks west on 36th Street. There is an elevation drop of about 4 feet, but this is enough to cause all higher ground rainwater runoff to flow to the lower parts of 36th Street, Holly said. Topography shows the intersections of 36th Street and Yvonne, Arizona, and Boston are the same elevation, completely flat, which is lower than Loop 464. Wilma and 36th is approximately 2 feet higher than Yvonne and 36th. Traveling east on 36th to the Thrasher development, the rise is another 6 feet when the loop is reached. To the north, 26th intersections are 2 to 4 feet higher than the intersections on 36th Street. The Thrasher development dug a new retention pond several years ago that receives overflow from Perch Pond via a ditch draining west under the loop to the Thrasher retention pond. quote, "What happened during the 2021 summer extreme rainfall event was city drainage ran to Perch Pond. Perch Pond overflowed into the canal ditch, which ran to the retention pond at Thresher Development, which overflowed, letting water run down 36th Street, which has no place for the water to go, causing flood damage to the area," Holly said. "The retention ponds are capable of holding water drainage from normal rainfall. It is the occasional very heavy rainfall that creates the overflowing ponds that cause flooding." Quote, "I felt like we needed more control of the situation. The city's pond overflows into a pond on private land where the county has no control on where the water goes. Michael Thresher has offered to give the county a deed to the pond on the Thresher Marital Trust property. This will put the pond under county control to do what is needed to institute flood prevention measures as needed. So I am asking the court to consider accepting the deed from the Thresher Marital Trust," Holly said. The commissioners made a motion on Judge Holly's request and approved the motion. In another agenda item, a discussion was opened to choose an architectural firm to start the designing stage of the new jail. Quote, "Selecting an architect under the Texas Professional Services Procurement Act is a two-step process. As a court, we select the most qualified provider and then attempt to negotiate a contract with that architect. If we are successful with the contract, then we move forward with the project," Holly said. Continuing to quote, "Three firms submitted their names and qualifications to be considered for the contract approval. The first was HDR, a very large national firm, Southwest Architects, and Burns Architecture," end quote. The court reviewed the formal packets of information submitted by each firm during a December 16th public meeting. Various county officials have made recent visits to jail facilities built by each of the submitting firms to visually see the work done on the structures, as well as talk to sheriffs, county judges, and others who were directly involved in the completion of each facility. Burns is a smaller quality firm that has built some very impressive jails, Judge Holly said. "We want our jail to look good for our community, and Burns' designs are really beautiful. Another plus for Burns is Jason Ross, who was the state jail inspector and now works for Burns Architecture. He knows all the state regulation and procedures," Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms said. Quote, "Burns has projects covering all of Texas," Precinct 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna said. Quote, "It's a hard decision, but I see advantages to Burns," Precinct 3 Commissioner Dexter Nichols said. Quote, "I have visited several jail facilities built by Southwest Architects and Burns Architecture and talked with different sheriffs. To me, the Burns facilities are impressive and more modernized. They do pod systems rather than catwalk designs, which I prefer," Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle said. Quote, "It's easier to have a closer working relationship with a smaller company," Holly said. The motion was made and seconded to choose Burns Architecture LLC firm to start plans on the new jail, which will be located just off the southwest corner of Parkway. Establishing a 2023 grievance committee was also on the court's agenda. Judge Holly read the names of those chosen. "The grievance committee is randomly picked from the grand jury list and can be called upon to listen to any elected official who has issues with their salary, which is set during the yearly budget changes each summer." Quote, "The grievance committee has never met during my time as county judge," Holly said. The commissioners also gave the Ward Memorial Hospital's administrator and CEO, Leticia Rodriguez, the approval to allow the hospital to offer reimbursement of recruitment and moving expenses. The hospital can offer $3,500 for expenses and up to $10,000 in bonus for employee changes without having to have the Commissioner's Court give approval, as long as the hospital follows the set financial guidelines passed by the Ward Memorial Hospital Board of Managers in late fall of 2022. Quote, "This will save the hospital and the Commissioner's Court time and not having to deal with redundancy," Rodriguez said. Present for the Monday, January 9th meeting were Precinct 1 Commissioner Tino Sanchez, Precinct 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna, Precinct 3 Commissioner Dexter Nichols, Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms, and Judge Holly. The next scheduled Commissioner's meeting is at 9:30 a.m. January 23rd in the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen. Individuals who would like to address the court to ask questions or inform the commissioners of problems in their precinct or Ward County can call Judge Greg Holly at 432-943-3209, discuss their question or concern, and ask to be placed on the agenda for the next commissioner's meeting. Grand jury indicts two in copper theft. Two of the three individuals suspected of stealing copper in October 2021 from North Alice Street have been indicted. Jazel Marie Munoz, age 24, and Marlon Deshaun Anderson, age 46, both of Monahans, were indicted by the Ward County Grand Jury of the 143rd Judicial Court on November 3, 2022. According to Captain Stormy Laws, quote, "Officers of the Monahans Police Department were notified of the possible theft around 5 p.m. when the property owner was told there were two individuals behind their trailer while not at home. The alleged theft occurred behind a trailer located in the 700 block of North Alice Street." Quote, "Munoz was parked in the alley posed as the getaway driver, while Anderson and Drayvon Adrian Ponce Smith, age 24, were stealing the copper," Laws said. "Both Anderson and Smith were able to flee the scene in the vehicle with Munoz before police arrival. Based on evidence obtained, officers were able to obtain warrants for all three individuals, charging them with engaging in organized criminal activity, a third-degree felony. It was not clear as of press time if Smith had in fact been indicted on the charge. Munoz is out on bond, and Anderson remains in custody at the Ward County Jail. City election slated for May 6th. VFD gets new officers." The story was written by Smokey Briggs. All councilmen and Mayor Adam Steen were present at Tuesday's regularly scheduled city council meeting. After approving the minutes from the previous meeting, the council approved a resolution to hold a general election on May 6th of this year to fill District 2 and 3 council seats, as well as the mayor. Currently, Jeppy Wilson represents District 2, and Calvin Carroll represents District 3. The council also approved new officers for the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department. According to City Manager Rex Thee, the officers are chosen by the firemen, but then must be approved by the City Council. The council approved the slate of officers as followed: Fire Chief Randy Crabtree, Assistant Chief John Bell, First Captain Cody Jimenez, Second Captain Ben McGilvray, Third Captain Roy Bean, Fourth Captain and Secretary Josh Smith, President Leroy Case, Vice President Chris Bates, Chaplain Cody Murphy. Thee also told the council that Quell Petroleum had made an offer to Brett Gregory to buy two aircraft hangars at the municipal airport, numbers 5 and number 10 in Hangar 13, for $15,000 each. According to the contract, the city has a right of first refusal regarding the sale of the hangars. Quote, I don't see a benefit to the city in owning these two hangars and recommend the city pass and allow Quail Petroleum to purchase them, Thee told the council. The council agreed with Thee's assessment and voted to pass on the purchase. After a brief closed session regarding appointments to the Airport Advisory Board, the council reconvened an open session and reappointed Vance Moore and Mike Harbin to continue serving on the board. Before adjourning, the group also okayed a request from Monahan's Community Church, formerly Crossroads Church, to close 3rd Street from South Allen to South Spruce from 3:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. on February 1st in relation to a ribbon-cutting event. Longtime district clerk retires. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. For the last 20 years, Patricia Oyebides has been the face of the Ward County District Clerk's Office, and as of Saturday, December 31st, she is officially retired. Oyebides worked for Ward County for a total of 27 years. Oyebides was honored with a retirement reception on Friday, December 30th, in the lobby on the second floor of the Ward County Courthouse, just outside the doors of the district courtroom, where she spent many hours. As her last days in office approached, Oyebides took time to reflect on her career. She first began as an employee for the county with then-county attorney Randy Cleveland in 1988. At the end of his term, Cleveland chose not to run for re-election, which left Oyebides without a job. Quote, "I was 7.5 months pregnant with our first child, so I decided to stay home," Oyebides said. Oyebides remained home with their children a little over 7 years, all the while helping with elections and filling in as needed in different county offices. Quote, "I worked the elections for then-county clerk Pat Finley and would work when people were out at the auditor's office or the county attorney's office," she said. Oyebides also served as an interpreter for former District Judge Bob Parks. Then, in 1995, Finley called Oyebides and offered her a job. Quote, "Pat called me and asked, 'Are you ready to go to work?'" Oyebides restarted her career in the Ward County Courthouse on April 24, 1995. Quote, "I thoroughly enjoyed my job in the clerk's office, working with Judy Greer, Judy McGrew, and Natrell Kane," she said. Then a phone call from Hal Upchurch would change the trajectory of her career once again. Quote, "I got a call, and the voice on the other end said, 'Joanne Wildes announced her retirement. Get your ducks in a row.' I was completely caught off guard. 'What was I getting my ducks in a row for?' I asked." Quote, "You're running for district clerk," Upchurch said. After talking about it with her husband Jorge and her daughters, Oyebides decided to run, and after running a successful campaign, Oyebides took office on January 1, 2003. While in office, Oyebides implemented taking passport applications, credit card payments, e-filing, and preserving older files. One of the last tasks completed by Oyebides was successfully getting the county on board with using an off-site online server, which will help prevent the county from having to replace expensive server equipment. Every December, Oyebides would feed the entire courthouse a chili meal along with desserts provided by the staff after the first of the year. Quote, "It has been an honor to serve as Ward County District Clerk, and I thank my husband and daughters for always supporting me through the years." Oyebides' daughters, Rebecca Oyebides and Sarah Garcia, put together a surprise retirement party for Patricia, which was held on January 6th at the Ward County Event Center. Over 100 family, friends, and current and former co-workers attended the celebration to offer their well wishes to Oyebides. Quote, As I look back on the last 27 years, 8 months, 8 days, my heart is content. I served the people of Ward County to the best of my ability. Now I look forward to spending more time with my family and my 2 grandchildren, Caden and Ava. Happy retirement, Patricia. Molinedo, named to All-State Choir. Monahans High School freshman Alexander Molinedo has been selected for the Texas All-State Choir. Molinedo competed for the spot in the choir on Saturday, January 7th, at Midland Legacy High School. Monahans High School Director of Choirs, Austin Billett, said, "Alexander is an exceptional singer. He spent a lot of time working toward this goal and competed well against very talented musicians. We are proud of his effort, and we can't wait to see how he grows over the next 3 years." Molinedo will perform with the All-State Choir in San Antonio on Saturday, February 11th, at the Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center as part of the 2023 Texas Music Educators Association Clinic and Convention. According to a press release from TMEA, quote, "Alexander was chosen for this prestigious honor through a competitive process held this year across the state at region and area levels. This is Alexander's first time to perform as a member of a TMEA All-State organization. High school students selected to perform in the All-State concerts have competed through auditions to qualify at the state level. All-State is the highest honor a Texas music student can receive. Of over 70,000 students who audition for various district, region, area, and All-State ensembles, 1,875 students end up being selected to perform in one of 18 ensembles in band, orchestra, and choir. To be selected as one of the top 2.6% of musicians in the state is the highest honor a Texas music student can receive. Leading up to the performances, the students must partake in 3 days of rehearsals directed by nationally recognized conductors by the Texas Music Educators Association. The performances from the ensembles at the Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center will conclude the event. Alexander is the son of Adriana Flores and Francisco Molinedo.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.